I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, news is breaking that there may be a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Nonetheless, I have a few more episodes in the Israel-Palestine series that should be released today and tomorrow. First up, human rights attorney and international law expert Scott Horton joins us to give his take on the recent flare-ups in the Middle East and to discuss the topic of APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, otherwise known as the Israel Lobby, which is now facing competition from J Street. We'll discuss all that and much more on this edition of Parallax Views. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Bare knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views. Scott Horton, an American attorney and writer at such places as Harper's Magazine, The American Lawyer, and The Daily Beast. How are you doing today?
Great. How are you?
Pretty good. And I'm also happy to hear the news that, based on what I'm seeing at places like Axios and a number of other websites, it seems we may have a ceasefire to the issue in the Middle East.
That's right. That's been reported. But let's say we should only be optimistic at this point because there's lots to still be confirmed.
So what is your general take on what has been happening the past week or so when it comes to Israel and Palestine?
It's really hard to divorce the developments from domestic Israeli politics and events going on inside of Israel. And it's one of those situations where if you say that this is all the result of event A, you're probably right. Event A had something to do with it, but there are probably a dozen other events that had a lot to do with it. So I think the situation is inordinately complex. And a lot of it has to do with the inability of Israel as a democratic state to produce stable governments, the sort of indecisiveness of the election, the very tenuous position of Benjamin Netanyahu, who knows that the one thing that will always find favor with his public in general is waging war with Hamas and dropping lots of bombs. And indeed, public polling in Israel in the last few weeks points to 70-80% of the public approving whatever pugnacious strategies are adopted towards Gaza. But then on the Palestinian side, you have the step-by-step dispossession of Palestinians from their residences in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, also creating a tremendous amount of tension. So it's a tinderbox, and the tinderbox produced explosions. The real losers in this are largely Palestinian civilians. I mean, to a lesser extent, also Israelis, but I'd say quite overwhelmingly Palestinian civilians, and particularly in Gaza.
Why do we say that it's been majorly Palestinian civilians? Because I think some people will try to argue that, and I don't think there's a good argument to say that they aren't really bearing the brunt of all this.
I think you just look at the statistics of who's died and who's been injured. It's overwhelming that it's Palestinians, and overwhelmingly Palestinians in Gaza. New York Times has, I think, done a pretty able job of flagging and locating the deaths. So it's certainly not the case that Israel is not beleaguered and threatened as well, but it's to a much smaller degree. And the major reason that that is so is the United States, because the United States provided Israel with the technology and funding for the Iron Dome system. And the Iron Dome system seems to work between 85 and 95% of the time. So that has that's essentially provided solid protection for Israeli civilians from the missiles, the sort of thing that the Palestinians don't have.
And since you mentioned Netanyahu and domestic politics in Israel, I feel like there's even elements in political life in Israel, based on folks I've talked to from there, that there may even be elements further to the right than Netanyahu.
That's definitely right. I mean, I think if we look at, we're coming up probably on the fifth election in the last 2 years. And if we look at these elections one after the next, they seem to suggest a steady march to the right and the further right, the irreconcilable right, I would say, including groups that are overtly racist, who reject any idea of any reconciliation or rights for Palestinians and so forth. So, and that's certainly a complication of the situation, because I would say reason does not govern in either political house. And the Israeli political house has become less rational over time.
And what do you make in terms of the U.S. response to the latest airstrikes in Gaza by Israel? What do you make of the response so far? Because a lot of people are saying that this feels like a sea change, that there's been a little bit more reporting that is at least somewhat sympathetic to the Palestinians. What do you make of all that?
Well, I think the situation is pretty complex. And because, we haven't been a fly on the wall in the discussions between Biden and Netanyahu, or in some of the discussions involving Secretary of State Blinken, it's sort of hard to say what's going on inside. But I guess I would start this analysis with the 30,000 foot view. And the 30,000 foot view, which I feel pretty comfortably reflects the views of the Biden administration and the Biden foreign policy team, starts with the proposition that the United States has made a significant strategic error over the last 20 years in putting too much of its resources and personnel into addressing Middle East problems, and that Middle East problems actually are not so essential to the security interests of the United States. So the proposition that they were, really goes back to analysis that was done in the mid-1970s and is really heavily focused on the fossil fuels industry and the need to get oil in and out and so on. That was the major case for the strategic significance of the Middle East. That case is, to say the least, no longer apparent. And I think another thing that goes with it is that there are four countries in this region that have played an outsized role in influencing American conduct in the region. And that influence is undesirable from the long-term perspective of U.S. foreign policy. And those countries are Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel. And they've each exercised tremendous influence over policymaking decision in different ways inside the U.S. But there's just no doubt that the four of them have, in fact, exercised enormous influence.
I want to come back to that, but I guess I wasn't even necessarily speaking in terms of the Biden administration so much as maybe like the U.S. media reaction. Do you feel like there's been a little bit of a difference this time around?
Yes, I think so. So I think if we and I think we can go straight to polling and polling, certainly polling over the last 20 years, take that same 20 year period and go back and judge it. And we are seeing a distinct modification of public attitudes towards Israel and the Middle East. And it's generational shift. So Biden's generation are all in for Israel, very hesitant ever to publicly contradict an Israeli leader or in any way signal hesitancy about them. The generation after Biden, a little bit less so. The generation after that, much less so. And the younger generation, I'd say the group characterized by the Squad and others, but not just them, largely view Israel as an apartheid regime, view the Likud party, the dominant political party in Israel, as an ally or an adjunct of the Republican Party. So sort of even in domestic political terms, an enemy, and therefore feel, you know, no reason to help them at all. They're very, very standoffish. And I would say, I mean, just I teach at Columbia University. I mean, I deal with student groups all the time. And to me, the shift there among students is really quite astonishing. And in fact, I would say Jewish student groups, it's rare that we find Jewish student groups that are willing to publicly express any support for the Likud government or the Likud regime. And most of them will openly decry the policies of apartheid. And in fact, I would say the call or the label of apartheid was highly controversial when Jimmy Carter used it. I can't think back how many years ago that was, many years ago. And today, it's not controversial at all. I mean, I think, you know, it's rare that I even see a reasoned defense mounted against that accusation.
Well, I was going to add to that. I mean, we also had the Human Rights Watch report come out recently, and it's not like you can call the Human Rights Watch report, you know, a very, you know, so far to the left. It's, you know, out on a limb sort of the political spectrum in the U.S. I mean, it's fairly mainstream.
I mean, that's certainly my view, is that Human Rights Watch is dead center. Human Rights Watch has, throughout its history, been very, very heavily funded and supported by Jewish philanthropy. And its staff reflects that. So Human Rights Watch has been critical of Israel in the past, but it's always been extraordinarily cautious in its criticism. And I think what we see now is reluctance to criticize Israel has just faded away.
And any brief comment as well on the resolution that Bernie Sanders introduced and its embrace by John Ossoff and others?
Yeah, I think it's really remarkable that we see two very prominent Jewish senators in the lead of this criticism. And by the way, I think this is also an increasingly mainstream perspective on the Democratic side, and that is, amongst other things, that Israel is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Israel has a budding and powerful arms industry. Israel is no longer surrounded by mortal enemies as it was 20 years ago, and that therefore the idea of this foreign aid and lethal aid being given in terms of billions of U.S. tax dollars to Israel seems ridiculous. And it doesn't stop there, because I think it would go on to say, and ditto for Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Why should we be loading this region with weapons and sophisticated weapon system? If our interest really is in securing peace, that's a pretty strange way to go about it.
Now, I'm glad we came back to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. And also, you know, I wanted to talk about AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. I guess there's always been this argument, especially within the sort of left wing of the political spectrum, about how much influence AIPAC wields, if it really influences, or if the U.S. itself just sort of considers Israel a strategic ally. Do you think there's truth to both, or that one is more true than the other?
It's difficult to say, and I would say that their influence is today, it's hugely in flux. So, I mean, it seems to me that 10 or 15 years ago, the influence was pretty apparent and obvious, and it had more to do with detail issues. So, the voice of the government in Tel Aviv and later in Jerusalem, was AIPAC. To the U.S. Congress. So what that government wanted would be conveyed to Congress via AIPAC, and AIPAC had, it is a political action committee. It funds and endorses candidates. Its seal of approval used to be very, very important politically. So it was influential. And I would say this is something different from other allies. I mean, if you look at the whole alliance structure of the United States, Israel was an important strategic ally. I think it's much less so today. I think that's a consensus view. Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Canada, these are more important than Israel today, and the assessment of just about all major leaders, all major analysts. And these other countries don't have an organization like AIPAC that influences and works with the government. So there was a differential quality about AIPAC. I think the relationship between AIPAC and the government in Israel also necessarily raised all sorts of questions. And to the point where, the question was raised by many people, and I agree with it, should AIPAC not have to register under FARA, the Foreign Agent Registration Act? Very fair question, given these relationships. It has not done so today, but probably it should.
Do you think the Mersheimer and Wolt book that sort of first brought this to people's attention, I feel like it was kind of unfairly attacked. I'm not sure that it was anti-Semitic. I felt like it tried to make a very reasoned case.
Well, I mean, I read the book when it came out. I had a discussion with historian at Columbia, is a good friend of mine, Fritz Stern, about it. And I think we have more or less the same reaction, which is that the analysis is obvious and is correct and is long overdue. It was probably sheer intimidation that prevented it from being made. But probably the packaging and presentation of the book was not quite as effective as it could have been. But that's superficial. I mean, I think the core of that analysis is correct. And the Israel lobby is a thing, and, it has been very, very powerful. But, this criticism gets brought out there just as AIPAC has passed its apex and is really beginning to deteriorate in terms of its efficacy and influence. And I think we see that today. And I think we see in the public presentation and the criticism of Israel and the bombing campaign. If we compare this with what happened in, let's say, 2014, with what's going on today, American media and American public opinion is, without any doubt, far more sharply critical of Israel. And I think, to some extent, that reflects the fact that AIPAC is just not so influential today as it was before.
I was just going to add to that, I mean, AIPAC also has competition now, because there's J Street, and I think the influence is waning. And I think I don't know if you would agree with this, but I think the years of scandals that happened in DC involving AIPAC, the Stephen Rosen scandal, may have had an impact.
To some extent, yes. I mean, and to some extent, J Street is an effective competitor. I mean, I have to say, I'm routinely looking at things that are sent out by AIPAC and things that are sent out by J Street and thinking, you know, AIPAC is so crude, so harsh, so demagogic in its style, it's just not effective. I mean, it's not effective with younger voters, particularly.
Just look at their, not to interrupt you, but just look at their attacks on Ilhan Omar, right?
A good example. I think it works with people who are over 60, maybe, but it doesn't work with people who are under 25. I mean, they're really quite turned off by it. And you look at who's crafting these attacks and everything. Well, you know, I mean, they've all got hardening of the arteries. I mean, that's my sense. I mean, there's just so little young blood in it. Whereas J Street, I mean, I constantly look at their materials and I say I find them quite persuasive. You know, and I would say just generally, I mean, no, I'm not anti-Zionist. You know, I mean, I know that on the left there's heavy attacks on Zionism all the time, and there are in the Arab world too. And it seems to me when I look at people like J Street and I look at Peter Beinart, for instance, it seems to me that there are moderate, rational, reasonable voices within the Zionist camp. I really don't have any problem with. What I have a problem with are people like Bibi Netanyahu.
Do you think that, and I think this is, you know, getting into the sort of final point of our sort of discussion here. Do you think that AIPAC sort of siding so much with maybe the Republican Party, especially in light of, you know, the Trump presidency, do you think that has really hurt AIPAC in the long run?
Definitely, I think it's hurt AIPAC. I mean, I think AIPAC, through most of its history, it made a point of being super partisan or bipartisan, not really making a difference between Democrats or Republicans. No one can say that with a straight face today. No one can say that. It has clearly aligned itself with the Republican Party, and it's aligned itself with, I'd say, some of the craziest people in the Republican Party, in particular the white evangelicals who really seem to be ascendant in the Republican Party today. You know, AIPAC indulges them, supports them, views them as a powerful, important ally. That's a huge turnoff for young people in the country. And I think that's something that's really undercut their influence. And I think, you know, the Likud party in Israel also made a clear decision that it was not going to stay aloof from American partisan politics. It decided that it was going to become an adjunct to the Republican Party. I mean, that's sort of the end of the road for Democrats and independents in dealing with and supporting the Likud, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating that AIPAC made that gamble, because it seems like what we're seeing with the Republican Party is potentially, I think on Facebook you put it as, you know, entering the final stages of a sociopathic breakdown.
You know, that's right. I mean, I think they're disintegrating just as the Republican Party is disintegrating. I mean, of course, America has throughout its history been a two-party system. There's always going to be space for a second party other than the Democratic Party. And frankly, the Democratic Party is the one that's always been there from the beginning to today, whereas the other party is the one that's changed. I mean, it was the Federalist Party, it was the Whig Party, now it's the Republican Party, and I think we're about to see something else form soon.
So in closing, anything else you believe that listeners should be considering when we discuss these topics like Israel, Palestine, Gaza, or even just lobbying and foreign lobbies?
You know, I think the lobbying point is extremely important. So it's very important for our voters to be conscious of efforts by foreign governments to influence them in their thought. I think they should be conscious of the fact that Middle Eastern governments have been working at this and they've been doing it very effectively for decades now. And it's not just Israel. I think in terms of money spent, it's almost certainly the Saudis who are spending more money in the American system and having more influence on things that they want. So I think that these are huge points. And the other thing is, you know, we got to get beyond this obsession with the Middle East. The Middle East is really not so important for the U.S. and U.S. security going forward. Other things are much more important for us. And I think, you know, particularly the situation in East Asia, our relationship with China is huge. If that gets disrupted, everything is made in China today. That's going to have tremendous impact on our economy and on the well-being of Americans.
And I just wanted to add to that with regards to foreign lobbies. I always try to tell people, you know, there's things like the Turkish lobby, which for years really prevented us from acknowledging the Armenian genocide. There's all kinds of lobbies.
Yeah, precisely. No, you're right. But they're there. They have influence. And it's not that it's evil or wrong for them to be there. They're entitled to be there. But they should be labeled. People should understand who they are and why they're doing what they're doing.
Well, I want to thank you again, Scott Horton, for being generous with your time. And let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work.
Well, I'm not doing a lot of writing these days because I'm practicing as an attorney, but I have a regular news feed that runs on Facebook that people can follow if they want to, and which I'm pulling out articles I think are important every day.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Scott Horton, human rights attorney and international law expert. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.